Proudly presented by the U.S. Army, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, counting you down toward the 75th anniversary of D-Day by hearing from people who were there. June 6, 1944 would be the first ever day of combat for a young man named David McCoy. He had escaped Oklahoma's Dust Bowl and made it to California, but 75 years ago he was with the 1st Infantry Division's 18th Regiment.
Well, the idea we had in combat was that we weren't going to make it home. That's the way we felt, the way we was involved in the battle and everything else. We just figured do the best we can because we didn't think we'd make it home. We were notified to prepare to go on a certain day, and of course then they called it off because the weather was too bad. And it's a good thing we didn't go that particular day because the Germans was thinking we were coming that particular day, and we didn't. So we went the next day, but the next day it was kind of rough because a lot of the guys got sick on the ship. I was on what they call a LST, where you load a lot of equipment and stuff, only a few troops on it. You get over there and they drop a ramp and you go off into the water and get onto the beach. So it was a rough deal going over that day we did, but the Germans had already moved out some of their troops because we didn't come the day we were supposed to, so it kind of helped us a bit.
Yeah, and there was another twist of fate that would help you out in your situation, but you mentioned driving a truck off the LST. What kind of truck was that? What was it carrying? How big was it?
It's an armored half-track ammunition carrier. I was loaded with ammunition. So I had to get off and get onto the beach, and I had to wait on the beach to make sure I got my four guns off, my four artillery pieces, if they got stranded in the water, because the water was still pretty deep, because when I got off, it come all the way up into my floorboard. And I had to wait on the sand to make sure I got my four guns off. If you understand what 4th of July is, it was 4th of July and then some.
And I want to touch on that. Let's come back to it. But before that, you were initially supposed to be one of the first ships getting there. You're supposed to be part of the first wave of American forces hitting the beach at Omaha Beach on D-Day?
That's correct. We were supposed to be in there, but we couldn't get in because the Navy would drop the anchor, and when he went to the end, he'd tell us to get off. Well, the first time he dropped it, we put one big truckload of ammunition off, and it went completely under. So they pulled out again, came back in the second time. We let some guys test the water, and they went under. So we pulled out, and our commander told the Navy commander, you either get us in this time or we're going to throw you overboard. I mean, we had to get in. So the third time was when my eye came off. Then I got off, like I say, and then I had to wait to get my four artillery pieces off.
So this is about, about noontime or early afternoon on D-Day?
No, it was just before noon.
Just before noon. And the people who did get in there at 6 o'clock in the morning got a very rude welcome, and it sounds like it wasn't very pleasant for you. You said 4th of July, and I think that tells us a little bit. Can you give us a sense of what you saw and what you heard as you drove that truck off that LST?
Well, even before I drove it off, we heard all the shells. The Germans did a lot of airburst. It was terrible before we got off, and hated to get off and go into all of that. But
and for people at home that weren't there and don't get what you're saying when you say an airburst, explain to us what that is and why that's so deadly and dangerous.
Well, it's a big shell that they fire at you, and it blows up in the air so that all the shrapnel will hit whoever's below, you know. Before I got off, I had binoculars, and I was looking over at one of the troop ships that was sitting there. It had got in there, and the tide went out, and it was setting up in the sand, and the troops were getting off, and I saw these troops going down the ramp, and they was falling off in the water about halfway down the ramp, and I kept looking, and I saw something, and then I spotted a machine gun up on the hill that was shooting the troops as he's coming down the ramp. I told my commander, and he called the destroyer escort that was right around us, and they spotted the machine gun, and they fired three shells. One shell went above it, one went below it, and one blew it up. We could see it blow up, and it set up there shooting our troops as they was coming off the ship.
Well, and I know you're not looking for the glory or a pat on the back here, but it sounds like you probably saved a lot of lives by spotting that and pointing it out to them.
Yeah.
And that's hard to talk about, I know, when you think about that. Maybe your own life was one of the ones saved in that process.
When I got my half-track off onto the sand and was just waiting, I was under heavy fire at the time. While I was sitting there waiting, one of the troops was laying over there, rolling, and I got out and went over and asked, "Are you hit? Are you hurt?" And I noticed it was a one-star general, and he was on our ship when I didn't know he was on there. And I said, "Are you hurt?" "No, I got to get this life belt off. We got to leave it on the beach." And I said, "USB, get the hell out of here." So I kicked him and told him go. And he run over to that ship. And just as I got my guns off, that ship blew up. So I don't know whether that general got killed or not. I never seen him after that. But we were getting heavy fire as I was coming off, real heavy. And some of the troops that we had on ship with us, they would get on the barrels of the gun as it's coming off and ride, and some of the air bursts knocked them off, and some of them got run over, and some of them got killed as it was coming off.
And I'm just trying to imagine, and I see the emotion in your eyes all these years later. I'm trying to imagine how you keep going in a situation like that. How do you, I mean, you said that you didn't expect to make it through, but that kind of cements it for you, doesn't it?
Yeah, it sure did. I was concerned because the half track was solid armor. But if I would have got an airburst right over it with all the ammunition I was carrying, it was a death trap.
Yeah, you would have blown here to smithereens. So you were unable to get on the beach and unload all your guns?
Yes. We got all the guns off of the beach. We got them up into position, and we pulled up the valley and got up on a hill and got settled down for the evening. I pulled a half track up on a hill and found a spot, and I dug like a grave. And then I drove my front wheels of my half track right over the grave, and then I slid under the grave, and I slept in there overnight. And I was still getting bullets fired at me, but they couldn't hit me because I was down in there. There was a German across a hedgerow that during the night. He'd fire, and the bullets would hit the hedgerow, and it'd go poop, poop. And at daylight, our troops come by and shot the guy just over the hedgerow. But then they go on to a little building that was there, and there was a person at little building that was directing the traffic for the Germans on the beach, and they shot the person. After they shot the person, they turned him over, and it was a woman, a German woman, directing all the fire on the beach. They had guns sitting in there about 5 miles in, shooting the big shells on the beach.
Well, and we're getting a taste of why June 6, 1944 has been called the longest day, and when you describe where you spent that night, and you talked about digging the grave and then parking your half track over it so nothing could get in that. Did someone teach you to do that, or is that just something you thought up?
Oh, that's something you do. You either dig a foxhole or you dig a grave, something you can get in. So I thought the easiest way was to dig that so I could lay in it at night. And I pulled a half track front wheels over it because the back wheels are all like caterpillar wheels. Right. So I had a good place to stay overnight.
But I imagine you didn't get much sleep.
No, I didn't get much sleep. I got a little bit of shut-eye, but not much.
And how do you wake up the next day ready to do anything after you've endured that? I mean, when they say the longest day, is that what it felt like to you?
Yeah, it was a long day, all right. I don't think we even was concerned about it. It was just so much action going on. And, of course, I didn't have any trouble waking up because all the fire going up all around me that next morning at daylight. So no problem.
I don't want to make you dwell on the stuff that's difficult to dwell on, but for those of us who weren't there and didn't experience it, what was the most difficult thing for you to witness that day?
I think the biggest problem was seeing so many bodies. It was a real disaster. Yeah. Most of my buddies were gone. Later on, about a week after we got in and so forth, well, maybe 2 weeks, I was still driving a half track, and on my half track, I had a machine gun, a 50 caliber, and a 30 caliber. The chaplain got on with me, and we were going to see about burying some bodies. So we pulled up this one place and got out, and we dug a grave for this body, and we was getting ready to put him in it. We had his tag and his helmet we was going to put on a stick there. We got ready to roll him in, and all hell broke loose. There was a bunch of Germans dug in on the hedgerow over on the side that our troops had already passed by, and they started firing at us. And the chaplain says, "Hell with that Heine, let's get out of here." So we left him, and we went and got in the half track, and they was firing at us. I get the 30 caliber machine gun and started firing back. 30 caliber don't do any good. So I rolled a 50 caliber around, and I fired it, and the Germans came out from the hedgerow. I think it was about 10 or 12 of them come out and surrendered. We held them there and called for backup, and they came and took them back. And then later after that, I went on up a ways further with our tanks. I think we had six tanks, and we was pulling into this field, and we was going to go in and park in the field. We get inside of there and run right into a big old Panther tank, and we had to get the hell out of there. And as we go out, our troops loaded up on the tanks, and the tanks come out, and they spun so fast in the road that one of the machine gunners in one of the tanks got thrown over, and he pulled the trigger, and he shot some of the soldiers on the tank in front of us. And I went out with a half track and tore up a bunch of communication lines as I was getting the hell out of there. Then it wasn't long after that until the commander's driver got injured, and the commander didn't have a driver, so nobody wanted to drive him because his Jeep has to stay right on the front line. So I told him if they get somebody to drive my death trap, I would take over. So I took over driving for the commander.
So you preferred driving the Jeep, even if you were on the front lines, to driving that half track?
Oh, yes, yes. Yeah, it was tough, but I enjoyed it more than I did driving a half track.
I know that this is all, at this point, every day probably is new experiences for you and things you've never seen before, but being with the regimental commander like that, did you get a different perspective on what was going on and what the war looked like to you?
Yeah, very much so. Very much so. I was involved with every bit of it. Sometimes I would be in a place where he'd tell me, don't you move until I call you. And I didn't get along with the captain or the major, and they was always trying to get after me. Every time they turned around to get after me, and of course I would go to the old man, which my commander, and tell him what's happened. And when I'd see them get out of line, I'd tell the commander, and he'd go over and chew them out, and they knew what was going on. So we had a battle between the major and the captain. The major was a big guy with a big goatee. All he'd do is pat his foot and twist his goatee and say, Corporal McCoy, you do this. And, you know, so he sent me on a deal one time. I almost got killed, and the commander, oh, man, he got after him.
Almost got killed. That sounds like another one of your close calls, huh?
Yeah, they hit my Jeep, blew a tire, knocked a tree down across my Jeep, and I managed to get away.
How'd you pull that off with a tree down over your Jeep?
Well, with the four-wheel drive, I managed to get out from under it, but still I had a flat tire, so I finally got down under a railroad track and had to put on a spare tire.
Well, see, I thought you were going to tell us that you were such a great driver that you had the same Jeep the entire way through the rest of the war.
Yeah.
Trying to be lighthearted with stuff that's still painful. I apologize, but you had three Jeeps?
Lost three Jeeps. Yeah, got all blown up, but luckily we didn't get hurt. The last one, like I say, P-51 and 47s were told to shoot anything in the area. And we had smoke screens and flares and everything else, and they came down and hit our Jeep. But the old man and I was in a ditch, so we were okay. So we didn't get hurt.
I realize this could be a needle in the haystack here, but of all the situations like that where it came close to your number being called, what's the one that took your breath away the most, or the one you think back on now and say, man, I was really fortunate to survive that?
Well, there were so many of them. The one that really got me was we were searching a house. I started over to the window to raise the window, and one of my guys knocked me down. And I, what the hell are you knocking me down for? He says, see that booby trap? So if I'd opened the window, I'd have got hit with a booby trap. Well, then as I go out the door, they had gone out, and just as I stepped out, a mortar landed right beside me at the door, but it was one of our mortars that hit the roof and slid off, and it was a dud. Oh. And they had to move me. I couldn't move. They had to come and get me.
I'd be frozen stiff, too, and I've had a few other veterans tell me stories like that where a dud landed right next to them. I imagine you're frozen there because you're still waiting for it to go off, right?
Oh, it scared me. I couldn't move. It's one of those things.
When you finally realize that it is a dud, and that you dodged that bullet, literally, what goes through your mind? Are you giving thanks to somebody? Are you just taking a deep breath, a sigh of relief? What do you do?
I don't really think about it. I know it's just one of those things. If I go, I go. And, you know, you're in combat, and you never know when it's going to go. We were standing around behind the openings on a 105 Hollister, one of the artillery pieces. And a bunch of us are standing there talking, and one of the Buddy said, I'm going to take a nap, and he laid over there and went to sleep. All of a sudden, in come shells. Wow, big air burst, and it didn't hit any of us, but we said, hey, he didn't even wake up. So we go over and pull the cover off of him, and he's all blown up. And that's how close it came to us. Just a lot of things like that happen. I was in so many different places to where that I'm just lucky to be here.
So many D-Day veterans would echo those sentiments from David McCoy from the 1st Infantry Division. Over the weeks ahead, we're going to be hearing from soldiers, sailors, paratroopers, and more who experienced the longest day firsthand. But straight ahead, someone who had to care for the wounded on June 6, 1944. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.